life would be, where you will go after you die.
Ever sit back and get a little too high, start thinking what happens to you when you die? Does your soul rest where your coffin is, or is death just a metamorphosis? Does life go on in the mental form? If we live a good life, will we get reborn? Is it a heaven or we trapped in hell? Where do we go from here? Nobody came back to tell. If we reincarnated or perish in time, could you shine with darkness and inherit your mind? And your eyes closed for good, you out the galaxy now. It's a subconscious dream, our reality.
This is Comics Therapy, Episode 16. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, we have three comics from November 6th, 2013. Ghosted number 5, 10 Grand number 5, and Trillium number 4. Plus your nerd confessions and nerd stories. On the couch, Eisner Award-winning artist and writer, Becky Cloonan. And just as a reminder, we don't do reviews, but we do talk a lot. So if you haven't read the books we're discussing, you may want to do so first to avoid any potential spoilers.
Given that it is the 5th of November, this felt like a fitting confession. Guys, I really prefer the movie to the book. I know, it's a masterwork, but I find it kind of tedious. And I like the movie in a big, dumb, action-y kind of movie way. I have much shame, and that is my confession.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say as serious advice. The theme of the show this week is what happens when we die. Make no bones about it, mortality sucks, no matter where or when you are. And you may have everything from ghosts to demons to the tearing of the fabric of reality itself to contend with once you or a loved one has shuffled off this mortal coil.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions and nerd stories. We want to hear and celebrate the little geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. Share them with us, and we'll share them on an upcoming episode of the show. You can call, Skype, or email your stories in, and all the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
And in between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers, and of course, the show account, at Comics Therapy. So, tell me something good, Aaron.
Man, I don't know.
Come on, it was a good week.
It was a great week for comics.
Yeah? How about anything else?
It's a fine week for everything else. We're trying to get ready to go on a little mini vacation this weekend, but...
Wait, I'm sorry. You on vacation? Like, not working?
I'm still bringing a laptop with me.
Right.
Wherever there's internet, there I am.
Right.
And it's just a pain in the ass to try to have fun with kids.
That's not true. Kids are awesome.
Yeah, not at my age. Kids my age. 35 is not awesome.
Well, you mean it's like trying to get like on the same page with a three-year-old?
Right. Well, yeah, I think Luke will have fun. Having a five-month-old, too, is an added stress to it. And then we're leaving the dogs at home. And the 19-year-old daughter is staying here with her boyfriend, and that's
Whoa.
Gross.
Whoa, back up. What?
Yeah, well, she moved out. What can you do?
Apparently not much.
No.
Ah, that's cool.
That's all right. I don't want to murder him, so he's the best of the lot so far.
I was living with my first boyfriend, like my first boyfriend that I lived with when I was 19, so.
I know, but you're a disgusting sinner.
Really? That's where we're going? Like, what? 3-4 minutes into the show, we're already there.
You brought it up.
I was just trying to give you context. That's like really all I do is provide context. And actually, because like I was so judgy, Judgerson, with that first comment about you letting your 19-year-old stay at your house with her boyfriend, I had to like temper it a little bit.
I hold her to a much higher standard than you.
Well,
I've accepted your shortcomings. I feel like there's still hope for her.
How is that a shortcoming?
It's just, I mean, what are we going to do at this point? What's done is done.
That's right. It was a really long time ago.
Oh, boy. So that's fine. I don't like leaving the dogs here without us.
Why aren't you taking them?
Because that's a huge pain in the ass. We're not like RV people or anything. Like, we're not going like four quadding what, or I'm not even sure what it is, but...
But you have guns and, like, a stockpiling of food, so...
I'm working on it. Give me 5 more years, and I'll have a fifth wheel and a big truck and ATVs and stuff, but baby steps.
Uh-huh. But you certainly have the beard to go along with it right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's you have to build the tower. You don't build it from the top down. You build it from the... You know, the basement up, and sometimes that basement has a trailer in the front yard and a car up on blocks, and you know, you just gotta work on it.
Man, your wife is a saint, an absolute saint.
Thank you.
It has nothing to do with you.
So anyway, we're gonna go out to the Oregon coast for a couple of days, and it'll be fine. It's just hard to break up the routines, like, When you plan for something like this, it's very apparent how every day of my life is pretty regimented. Like, there's stuff that happens every day, and it's really hard OCD. To confront it. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it as I have a full life that's very busy. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to change that busyness. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I have to wash my hands 50 times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long are you guys going to stay out there?
Like a day and a half.
So you need a vacation before the vacation, and then you'll need one to recover after the vacation.
Well, I don't really feel like it's a vacation when you have to take your kids with you, because you're still then like trying to get them to sleep in an unfamiliar place, and they're not going to sleep well.
No, you're right. You're right. Being a parent is hard.
It's not relaxing.
Right.
But it should be fun.
Yeah. Do they still have the seals out there?
Yeah. I believe there are still seals in the ocean.
No, but I mean, like, they had a special place where you could go and... have, like, up-close encounters with the seals.
Yeah, that's all over the Oregon coast.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to do that. We're going to go to the Goonies house.
Right.
Which is exciting.
That's important. Maybe thematically, Avi and I will watch Goonies this weekend, just so that we can, like, feel closer to you.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be there. So, yeah, that's our week that's been planned. How about you?
It was a little crazy week. My mom's been really sick, so I've been, you know, dealing with that and feeling, like, really far away from Pittsburgh, which is a, I don't know, it's like an odd experience to be super happy where I am, because I love the Bay Area, but this is probably one of the few times that I can say over the past year and a half that I've just really wanted to be, like, home, where I guess... More specifically, where this doesn't feel like home. Because normally, it really does. It's just kind of a magical, obnoxious California paradise. Except when stuff at home isn't quite where you want it to be. So, it's a weird feeling. But, you know, it's, 3 weeks until Thanksgiving? So, mm-hmm. I guess I have felt more this past week, like... This is so silly, but, like, much younger, much more, like, unmoored, you know, because I didn't move away when I was 19, living sinfully with my boyfriend. I was still in Pittsburgh, and I was when I was 25, and I was when I was 30. And so now that I'm in my mid-30s, I'm having these, like, strange detachment experiences, like most people got out of their system when they were much younger. So, whatever. I've been at home a lot alone. I think too much. Shut up.
No, it's different. Like, when I, like, for me, so I live 8 hours driving away from my parents.
Right.
But you live 8 hours flying away from your parents.
Yeah, and about that.
Even though it might be the same amount of time to get back home, it's a much different kind of thing.
Oh, totally. You can't just jump into the car and head off home. There's a lot of planning that goes into any sort of trip that involves a plane, like that has to involve a plane to be realistic. I've driven across the country a bunch of times, and it's something that you do when you can, not really because you have to. I mean, ideally, I guess if we had to jump in the car and just drive straight for whatever it is, 37 hours, something like that. That sounds horrifying. Not going to be doing that anytime soon.
Right. Not until you get your fifth wheel.
Yeah, that... No.
We'll see. We're only, like, a couple months into this podcast.
So much
can change. A year from now, you're going to own, like, 6 pages, original pages of The Walking Dead. You're going to have a whole survival bunker.
How on earth would that... No. Those two things do not go go together at all.
Oh, you'll see.
Uh-huh.
Grasshopper, you are so young.
You're projecting.
And you're learning.
You're projecting way, way too much.
I think I've just introduced this a little too early. We'll revisit this discussion in a couple months.
Mm-hmm. How about let's talk about, I think, the best comic of the week. And I'm glad that you also think the best comic of the week. Do you want to talk about it for your little 90 seconds of glory?
Sure, whatever.
Each week I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. 90 seconds, one book, one new comic from the past week that we're not analyzing. This time he chose wisely. I totally approve and sanction completely his choice. Are you ready?
Yes.
Dude, if you now go off the deep end and start talking about something else...
I'm so tempted to.
Fuck.
I'm not okay. Going to, though.
Good. Ready? Go.
Okay. So let's talk about Captain Marvel 17. I don't like talking about comic books that make me cry. I'm a powerful, like, whatever, monolith of a man. And the monolith doesn't cry. But sometimes you get tears from a stone. Yeah, this is a great book, and it's the perfect example of that line between pandering and evoking emotion that's really hard to pull off, I think. And okay. Every once in a while you get that perfect storm of art and writing and the buildup of a story that culminates in this emotional release that isn't false. And that's how I felt about this comic. You know, it wasn't like sobbing because it's so sad or anything like that. It was more sobbing like because it's just very emotional. It's evoking a lot of stuff, especially parental, you know, kids and parents and protectors and everything that really superhero comics are great about being. Like, it really made me think about what's important about a superhero comic. It's evoking those emotions of triumph and protection and what a hero is. A hero isn't just about fighting the big bad guy. It's about taking care of the little guy and inspiring greatness in the common person.
Wow.
That was executed perfectly.
That was beautiful, Aaron.
Thanks.
I also completely agree, as you know. I think it was just a stunning, stunning issue. And what a way to end that particular run before the relaunch. So,
yeah.
God, so beautiful.
And some a really good teaser for an upcoming series.
Yeah, absolutely. Ms. Marvel sounds like it's going to be a blast. So it was a nice little moment at the end of Captain Marvel 17 to, as if we weren't excited enough.
But it was that teaser where it's not like, oh, just cut to this. It was within the emotional, you know, realm of what the whole issue was about. It was that inspiration, and then suddenly you have this new hero emerge.
Yeah. So good.
Awesome.
So uplifting, and yet now we're going to switch gears and talk about, like, death and, like, scary shit. So let's get started.
All right, let's do it.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. It's Jason Sachs from Comics Bulletin at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. That's with a K, not with an H, darn it. I'm calling with my nerd confession this week, and it's actually an answer to a nerd confession that you had on your Terry Moore episode. See, I don't care at all about continuity, not in the tiniest little bit. It doesn't bother me the slightest little smidge if a character is involved in some galaxy-spanning epic in one book and is doing something completely unrelated in the other. It just doesn't matter. I love having certain sections of my mind that are devoted to epic events, certain sections of my mind that are devoted to individual stories, and I don't care if they don't cross over because it's all comics, and in that way, it all passed deep into the past, and everything will just kind of all merge together in a great, happy, gooey glob of cool old comic stories. So I have the long view, because it's all good in my mind. Thanks. Bye.
Our first book this week is Ghosted Number 5, written by Josh Williamson, drawn by Goran Saduka, colors by Miroslav Mirva, and lettering by Russ Wooten. Ghosted is published by Image Comics.
Jackson Winters is a con artist sprung from prison to steal a ghost from haunted Trask Mansion. He assembles a team, the Muscle, the Psychic, the Stage Magician, the Skeptic, and the Reality TV Ghost Hunters, and sets up a very admirable guideline that all surveillance must be done during the daylight hours only. Jackson has a secret from his past, the details of the heist gone terribly wrong that led to his incarceration, that neither we nor his team know the full extent of, but it seems that Trask Mansion is not his first brush with demons, and the details of his current arrangement may not be quite as they first seemed.
So, you hadn't been reading this.
I had not been reading it.
And it's, you just shotgunned it all, so what did you think?
Well, it's a horror book, so I don't typically seek those out.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a track record of making just extraordinarily poor decisions when it comes to actually sitting down to read these books.
Yep.
Mostly, it takes place between the hours of 1 and 3 a.m.
Perfect.
Not really. Not for somebody of my...
mental
weak
state?
Constitution.
Oh, sure. Okay, that works too.
So, yeah, there were absolutely some, like, shrieky moments for me. Definitely regretted when I sat down to start them. And I guess, stepping back now a couple of days later, that's probably the hallmark of a fairly effective horror comic.
Yeah, but it's also a heist comic, too.
Right! So that's a good balance for me, as it turns out, because the... You know that the, like, cast of characters feel of, like, oh, I know these guys. Like,
yeah, it's a common thing, but it never gets old. It never gets old for me.
No, absolutely. I completely agree. And it tempers the horror in a way that makes it... I don't know. It's a nice blending of two genres.
Yes. And it's also a blending of two genres that I don't think has really been done before. Not in this way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So besides that, it brings up a lot of, I don't know, I think it brings up a lot of fun discussion topics and things to think about. And it's, you know, it's the having this main character and these reveals of supernatural kind of encounters. And it's, you know, when I was reading it, and this is going to seem kind of scattered, but you get, you know, you're reading and you're like, well, they don't seem very phased by this, or he doesn't seem very phased by this. And it's like, they really should be, because some pretty crazy stuff's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Until you get these reveals of, like, oh, what happened in the past, and why he's there, even, and how this is going to play out. And I like that aspect, and that's kind of the aspect of the heist comic, typically. Mm-hmm. But this is done in a horror setting. It's just good.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting juxtaposition with his, like, personality, because, like I said, he's just as familiar of a type as the rest of them, but you're right, in this environment, it feels, I don't know, it kind of makes the horror part more approachable, and yet, okay, so the moment where he, I think it's at the end of the third issue, where the kind of final reveal with him and the noose, and mm-hmm. you're like, what just happened? Especially because I guess that's the kind of first moment of violence between the ghosts of the house and the team.
Yeah.
Well, that issue is the first moment. He's so like whatever about it. The next time we see him, he's so matter of fact.
Right.
And I think that as this series continues, I'm like, I guess I'm really sort of interested in like where he fits in that kind of larger blending of heist and supernatural, because I think that they've got a good thing going there with how kind of cool and collected he is.
Yeah, but that's also a very good hallmark of the head of any kind of, like, you know, team.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thieving team. So it's taking this stuff that's been well done over and over and over, but putting it in such a context that it takes in the dead and the undead and sorcery and everything else. And it's a good mashup. And sometimes a mashup feels like a brand new thing.
Yeah. I hope that as it continues, the team feature is like a prominent part of the stories.
Right, like the second arc is, let's get the team back together for one more time.
Right, and honestly, even if the team itself shifts slightly, because, you know, we've lost at least one, possibly two members of the team, none of whom he was really an ally with. So if the exact individuals of the team change, I'm fine with that. But I think that's the, like, the camaraderie during the investigation is, or lack thereof, is actually what kind of makes this work.
Yeah, yeah.
So if it's just him, there's a danger of it being like another ghost hunter kind of story, and that's not what it's been so far. So I'm hoping that's where it continues.
I think we're not going to be disappointed. So I talked to Josh Williamson about this at Rose City Comic Con.
Oh, did you?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. And?
It's very exciting to see somebody so excited about their story.
Oh, yay.
And to not, he didn't spoil it, but it's going to be fun, I think. He's definitely got a plan, a long-term plan for it. The arcs are written out, there's a long story, and they kind of fold in on each other, and, mm-hmm. It's not self-contained in that way. There's more to be revealed.
And that's cool.
Yeah, it's just really cool to see, like, somebody who's pretty, a younger writer who has a lot to say and is really excited about the story they're telling.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I think that's all we probably need to say for now. You ready to move on?
Yep.
Okay.
The world's favorite comic book hero, followed by 84 million readers a year. Now, he comes alive. For the first time on the screen, you'll see it all. The spectacular adventures of the amazing Spider-Man.
Next up, we have 10 Grand Number 5, written by J. Michael Straczynski, with art by C.P. Smith, and lettering by Troy Petteri. 10 Grand is also published by Image Comics.
I'm just going to read the recap at the start of this particular issue. There's been a bit of a break since the previous one, and there's a lot going on. Joe Fitzgerald, a former mob enforcer, promised the love of his life that he'd quit after one last job. He never imagined that his target might have demonic connections who killed Joe and Laura. As he lay dying, an angelic force offered him a deal. In exchange for his services, he'll be able to see Laura for 5 minutes every time he dies in a righteous cause, and then resurrected to continue the fight. Joe's latest assignment, helping a woman named Debbie search for her missing sister Sarah, who at last report had joined a cult named Divine Will, has also put him on a path to the man who killed Laura. There's just one problem. Joe put a bullet in his head 2 years ago. He should be dead. But then again, so should Joe. While attempting to reach his contact on the other side, Joe discovers that she and Laura are not in heaven or anywhere in between. That leaves only one place they could be, and Joe has just arrived.
Yeah, I mean, aside from story, this is a really... I find what's really interesting about this is more these... it's the revenge, it's the payback, it's the it's the bad guy doing good things to try to be a good guy.
Oh, sure. That's an incredibly attractive, character trait and story catalyst.
Yeah, but why are we as people attracted to that? I mean, do we like a redemption story?
Yes, absolutely.
I guess so.
I think, of course we do. We want to know that everyone is capable of good.
I guess so. I mean, I guess that's a sort of a tenet of Christianity too, right?
I think it's a tenet of a lot of different belief systems, not necessarily Western or Judeo-Christian exclusively, but I think that there's a hope inherent in talking about redemption, that, like, even if you do something bad, you can make good.
Yeah.
And in this particular instance, the bad is really quite bad. Both in terms of, like, what Joe did when he was living and what he is dealing with overcoming in this kind of non-living or
Well, he's also finding out what he thought was good isn't necessarily good, and what he thinks is bad isn't necessarily bad either, and that's right. That blurred line. But that's fine, because I think that's a very human experience, too. Like, good and bad are somewhat subjective. Like, I mean, there's hard lines between them. Like, murder, bad. Mostly.
Always.
Always?
Oh, God. Okay, mostly.
Yeah, mostly. So that's why nothing's ever black and white. But we live our lives kind of assuming there are black and whites to the world until we're actually confronted with them.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, I mean, that's, I think, what this story is a lot about. And it's also kind of facing your past and your present and your future, especially in this last issue.
I think...
And doing things outside and not for yourself.
Right. The love story is what... For me, is what makes this so compelling.
Yeah.
I think it's a sort of beautiful combination of character moments, of like the hardness of Joe and his past and like who he was, and yet this really like incredibly beautiful and enviable thing that he had with Laura that is worth more to him than his life itself. God, that's gorgeous.
Does that ever happen, though? I think we have this idealized thing in stories of especially the bad person who does good things for love. Love is the catalyst that turns them to good. And I don't know why we have this fascination in literature with that, because I don't think it ever really happens in real life.
But does it need to? It's such a... I don't know. It's such a beautiful image, and there's a lot of stuff that happens in literature that's never going to happen in real life. The entire comics industry is based around telling stories that are not going to happen in real life, and I am a fucking champion of all of that, because it's really nice to escape from real life sometimes.
True. And maybe it's part of that, it's the biblical part of comics and stories in themselves of telling things that we wish would happen, or that we're striving towards, you know, for our own redemption. Basically, but what I'm saying is it's time for us to get baptized.
No, shut up.
Okay.
I think that the notion of love beyond death is like a much, much larger, like, human desire. And the notion of somebody fighting death because of love, and like in this case, he is literally traveling through the bowels of the like hell kind of construct to rescue his love. That's not new. That's a tenet of stories for centuries.
Right.
So it's a human nature thing to like be afraid of what happens after you die, but to simultaneously want to know that there's somebody who's gonna, I don't know, help you deal with it, or like come and rescue you from it. And he's kind of a badass.
Yep. Yeah, true. A hero in this life and beyond.
I'm a sucker for a guy in a leather jacket.
Yeah, me too. Amen. All right, well, talking about stories that span centuries, do you want to move on?
Yes. Yes, all right. We can move on.
Hi, Aaron and Andrea. My nerd confession is that since I've been collecting comics from the age of around 10, I've never had a pull list. In fact, I've never been to a local comic store on a new comic book day, like ever. The nearest store is a 3-hour drive from my house. So every book I read, other than digital, is months old at best. This is Brad at Comic Wasteland. Okay, keep up the good work. Love the show. Okay, bye-bye.
Finally, let's talk about Trillium number 4, the halfway point of the miniseries by Jeff Lemire, published by Vertigo Comics. Jeff was assisted on color by Jose Villarubia?
Probably.
Via
with the two L's. Yeah.
All right. And lettering is by Carlos Mengual.
I don't know why I let you do this every week. Yeah. Maybe I should introduce them.
Or you're writing them out. How about you do them phonetically for me?
You don't read the script anyway, Aaron.
Yeah, but I'd read it in real time. How about we just drop in like robotic voices? Let's just talk about the story, please.
There's a lot going on here that I want to talk about. So here's the basic premise from the Vertigo site for anyone who hasn't picked up the first four issues and is still somehow crazily listening to us. It's the year 3797, and botanist Nika Temsmith is researching a strange species on a remote science station near the outermost rim of colonized space. It's the year 1921, and renowned English explorer William Pike leads an expedition into the dense jungles of Peru in search of the fabled Lost Temple of the Incas, an elusive sanctuary said to have strange healing properties. Two disparate souls separated by thousands of years and hundreds of millions of miles, yet they will fall in love and as a result bring about the end of the universe. Even though reality is unraveling all around them, nothing can pull them apart. This isn't just a love story. It's the last love story ever told.
Mm-hmm. How good is this book?
So good.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's good in the way that, mind management is good. Mm-hmm. In, I'm trying to think of another example of being simultaneously just joyfully confused about where this is going to go and yet like not wanting it to ever stop.
Yeah. Yeah, like Morning Glories in a way.
Yeah.
Has a lot of that. Mind the Gap.
Very different tone, but yeah.
Right. This book kind of panders to me a little too much because it's about sci-fi and time travel and even the relationship stuff too. I mean, it's all good.
Yeah. It is.
It's funny too because I think his art, I had to be reminded that Lemire's art style is an acquired taste and it doesn't always click with people.
Okay.
Especially if they haven't, I don't think if they've been reading comics for a long time, it necessarily clicks with everyone. I was talking to a relatively new reader at the local comic book shop who's been coming by, like she's there at the store opening now, like every week. And I was saying, like, have you been reading Trillium? And she's like, yeah, you know, I picked up the first issue, and I just really didn't like the art style. And I'm almost like, what? We're done talking. But I had to think, like, it's a very unique art style.
It is.
But it's so evocative, and it's so emotional.
It's very much more expressive than realistic. And I think that if you're not familiar with it, I don't think it's just about comics, but certainly if you're not familiar with just the difference that drawing expressively as opposed to realistically can bring to a story, then sure.
Yeah.
It can look like juvenile and unsophisticated when in fact it's not at all.
No, it's incredibly complex.
Right.
So as far as like the story and the themes coming up, I mean, the whole love story that spans ages and mm-hmm. that fading of the human light, you know?
It's really, like the death of everything.
But it's not the death of everything, though. It's the death of humanity.
Right. Okay. Fair.
But it's interesting because it's such a human thing to place ourselves at the center of everything. Right.
Right.
But, you know, if you really look at it, there's this alien.
Hey, I'm the one who's not a robot, so all I did was just prove that.
No, it's fine. It's also an interesting kind of characteristic of the book, though, that humanity is dying, but there are obviously other species within the universe that are encountered that are entwined in our fate, but would go on without us if we weren't around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the universe would continue. So, I mean, that's just part of a sentient species to place ourselves at the center of all creation.
Right.
But this is a good reminder like that.
It makes me... I didn't quite mean it like that, but yeah, no, fair.
But it's very everything, fair. Especially when it comes to sci-fi or especially, I mean, look at DC or Marvel Comics. I mean, the Earth is the center of all conflict, you know, even if mm-hmm. you go back to something like Infinity or something. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the most important planet in the universe of millions and millions of worlds? It's always the hub is Earth.
Right.
And that's fine. Well, I like it.
In Trillium, Earth isn't in the future component of the story. Earth is gone.
Right.
So there's also this kind of yearning
to go back, though.
And to go back, right. Right.
It's where the story kind of, you know, coincides. It's right. That nexus of the earth is the nexus still. But it's, and that yin and yang of the male and female coming together. And it, you know, it's just, I love the complexity that sci-fi allows for stories. And right. This was the end. I'm excited to see what happens after the end.
Right. I mean, I know you know this because I texted it to you, but I was like, what? What do you mean the end? That's not like the end, right? What is everything that I know about this wrong? No, but it was an effective stopping point for kind of the matching of, I don't know, it's all about symmetry, right? So it's going to most likely match up to the second half, and that we're going to like meet it in the middle, just like we did in the first issue. And I don't know, maybe where the end ends is where the beginning begins. I don't know.
Which is fine. You really don't need to know. And maybe we don't even know at the end too.
Oh yeah. This is the kind of story that I can end with lots of questions. Like, truly, if this had been the end after issue 4, I would not have been angry. I would have felt a little like, whoa, because there's been so much in those first 4. And I think I would have been disappointed that it wasn't continuing. But I think I would have been fulfilled because there's like great things happening and great things being said. So knowing that we're going to get the mirror image, or I guess I'm assuming we're going to get the mirror image of what happens after the end now is exciting.
Yeah. Well, with every ending, you have a beginning.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
Just like at the end of this segment, we'll have the beginning of a great interview with Becky Cloonan.
Oh, such a good interview. Becky's awesome.
Well, should we get to that?
Yeah, good stuff.
So just so everyone knows, this was recorded earlier, and it was over Skype, so the audio quality might not be as good as the regular show, but it was an amazing interview, and we thank Becky so much for being on with us, and always. We hope you enjoy it.
Yep, thanks, guys.
Hi, this is Avi. I just want to talk about my favorite character, Iron Man. He's my favorite character because he controls a lot of things by using Jarvis's computer. He can also shoot beams from his arc reactor and hands. I also like him because besides that, he also uses his armor to protect himself and other people. Thank you.
This week on The Couch, we welcome award-winning artist and writer Becky Cloonan. Becky is known for her self-published works like The Mire, for which she took home an Eisner this year for the best single issue or one-shot. She also worked on well-known titles for Vertigo, Dark Horse, Image, and Marvel, and was the first woman to draw DC's main Batman title last year. She's currently drawing The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys, which we talked about back in episode 4, and we're really excited to have her on the show. Thanks for hanging out with us, Becky.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, very exciting. I mean, let's be honest, you kind of invited yourself.
I totally did. I was just, well, someone, it was a Twitter thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we blame Twitter for a lot of our choices.
Wait, why is this a blame thing? I think this is an exciting thing.
We celebrate Twitter for a lot of our choices.
That's true.
It was... bullied my way on the show. I've enjoyed your podcast in the past, though, so.
Oh, thank you.
We are seriously ecstatic that you are hanging out with us today. Because you're super busy. Why don't you start by just giving us a breakdown of what you're currently working on? And I don't know, maybe what's in the hopper, if there's something you can tell us about.
Well, let me see. There's True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys, yes. Which is pretty much wrapped. There is the Young Avengers. Ooh, shit, I forget what issue it is. Oh, I think it's like a December issue.
Okay.
Maybe it's like a New Year's issue, I think. Because it's New Year's in the comics, so I'm assuming it like comes out like in around New Year's.
I don't know. Sometimes the comics, they're like, this is February's issue.
Yeah, maybe. You know, it's pretty cool. There's like, it's like a mashup. So there's a bunch of different creators working on this book, including like Emma Vicelli and like Annie Wu. And so it's pretty cool. There's like, I only did like 5 pages in it. So.
Awesome.
But that was fun. And then after that, I'm jumping on I'm doing a short little thing. I can't really talk too much about it right now, but I'm doing a short story with Ollie Moss.
Oh, nice.
He's writing it, so that should be interesting. And then I'm jumping onto a graphic novel that I'm adapting for First Second.
Oh, wow. So that would be like a year and a half off?
Yeah.
Know, well, right? It takes a while.
It does. It does. Hopefully I'll do it in a year. I'm hoping that I've already blocked the whole thing out. So it's just a matter of like doing the thumbnails now. And then I'm trying to streamline my system with this graphic novel. And I don't work digitally, but I just got a Cintiq.
That seems to be the trend for a lot of artists who still want to work pen and paper, but do all their thumbnailing on the Cintiq.
Yeah, I'm hoping that it kind of saves a little bit of time with the thumbnails. I know there's Manga Studio is great for like laying out pages and stuff, and then I'm hoping to do my thumbnails and rough pencils and maybe even tight pencils in the computer and then print those out and then ink over that. Save some time too, especially if I like, you know, if I'm able to lay out where my word balloons are going to go, I can actually draw those in by hand, which would save me a little bit of time too, because then you won't spend the entire time drawing a library and draw all these books and then have to cover them with a word balloon. Or like, I'm going to draw this castle and there's all these bricks everywhere. And then you cover half of them up with your huge word balloon. So I think that it might end up saving. So it's like it's a big investment, but I think for the graphic novel, it'll be a fun thing to try out and see if I can streamline things.
It's an investment of time too, to just get it up to get yourself, I guess, up to speed with being comfortable with the technology and like you said, adapting the way that you have been working and incorporating that into your process.
Yeah. Well, I've done a bunch of times in the past, I'll like draw my thumbnails tight enough so that I can scan them in and then blow them up in Photoshop and then use those as my like print those out really light and then use those as my roughs, which that saves a bit of time. And I think if I'm not inking in Manga Studio, if I still ink traditionally, you know, I can still keep that feeling, but and I won't have to learn how to be really tight with the program either.
Can I ask a weird separate part of like the comics industry, but you know, original art sales, and this just got me thinking about the move to digital for some artists is, you know, if you're doing a lot more in digital, then you don't have as many original pages. And I'm always just kind of curious how much on the business side, like income from selling original artwork brings in, and is that ever a consideration for like changing, you know, your production style?
I don't think it would. Well, for me, I sell a bit of pages. I don't sell too many, but I price them kind of high, so I think that's probably why. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I make enough with it that if, you know, if I cut my originals out and I decided to go all digital for some reason, I wouldn't really be losing that much money. And I guess the idea is that the time that you save, you'll be able to draw more, you'll be able to produce more,
right.
And then so you'll make more money, I guess. There's the thing too. It's like with comics, if you make a book that has a long shelf life, then those pages will be in demand constantly. But if you're just working on a book that comes out and then after, you know, the book comes out, you might sell a few pages from that. And then the trade will come out and you might sell a few more pages. But, you know, some books I've worked on, it's like I'm not going to see, you know, sales of those pages. They're not really going to be in demand because the book either doesn't have a shelf life or, you know, is kind of forgotten about after the initial push.
Right.
So there's that.
Yeah, it's just sort of a field from what we normally talk about, but I'm always just kind of curious when I see artists kind of making that switch to a digital format. And
I mean, that's one thing, but I think it's only a small bit of the reason to, you know, switch to digital. Uh-huh.
Did you always know that you wanted to be an artist?
Yeah, I did.
So what,
I think so.
What's your earliest memory of drawing or making stories up when you were a kid?
I can remember drawing, I think, from kindergarten, even before that. You know, I used to make little books, like little, and it's weird because all my books were like sequential in nature. They were like story books where there'd be like an illustration on one page and then like a line of text on the bottom. And then I flip the pages. So I do comics about outer space and I do comics about dinosaurs. And I call them comics. They're not really, they're just kind of storybooks.
Nice. Little like golden books. Text.
Yeah, crude golden books. No, I just think it's always been something that like storytelling, I think, has always been in kind of my nature.
So is that, I guess the story part of your art is the difference between just wanting to be an artist for art's sake and wanting to be an artist to tell a story?
Yeah, definitely.
And it seems like that's always been the way that you've approached art then.
Yes. And I was thinking about that a little while ago and it just kind of you know, I was back at home at my mom's house, which is the house that I grew up in. And it's, you know, she's got a bunch of my stuff saved in the basement, and anything that didn't get damaged in like floods or whatever, she still has like hanging out. And I was looking through a bunch of it, and it was just all very sequential. You know, like there's all like a big, there's a story that runs through every single one of them. Just kind of
funny.
Did
you read comics when you were a kid too?
I did, actually. My dad would read me Silver Surfer comics and Fantastic Four. So that's, you know, as like bedtime stories.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
But, you know, it's one of those things where you don't get every issue. So you'd have to like make up what happens in between each issue also. Because I think they used to have a spinner rack at my grocery store. I'm dating myself right now. But you know, it's like you don't always get to buy a comic, and you wouldn't always, you know, get, you might have like four or five issues in between where you don't know what happened. So you're kind of like making it up in your head.
I never really thought about that, but in a way, isn't that great for stimulating your imagination? Because you, with only half the story, you have to force your brain to kind of fill in the blanks.
Yeah, and it was definitely like, you know, there's that interactive kind of overactive imagination.
Yeah.
It goes along with it, and it just, you know, just makes you think more about these characters, and it makes you like them even more. As a kid, it was, you know, it was kind of cool.
Well, so going forward though to modern times, you know, there's definitely a different process between doing your own works that you are both writing and drawing, and then collaborating with writers. And I think it's probably safe to say that starting in the industry, you were doing the art and someone else was writing, and you made a shift at some point to doing your own works as well. What have you taken as the process, the differences in those two processes, and like how did you learn to make your own comics, I would say, from working with other people?
Yeah, it's crazy because when I was in high school, I think I knew I wanted to do comics from about, you know, high school age, maybe like 15 or 16.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, I was always writing and drawing my own stuff. And so I had this, you know, idea in my head that like, oh, I'm going to be like, you know, I'm going to draw my own comics and be able to like write my own stories and stuff. And then when, you know, when I got to college, I was majoring in animation. I didn't go into comics.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan, and I ended up dropping out in my third year. So that didn't go well. Went well. The school was great, but I just was like, it's expensive and animation sucks, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it wasn't for me. So I dropped out, and I ended up working with Brian Wood, who saw a bunch of my mini comics. And my mini comics at the time were very like experimental and very like, you know, they weren't really, I wasn't really telling a story. I was more just trying to figure out technique and, you know, figure out what, where my voice was at the time. And Brian Wood saw it, and I guess he liked it because he asked me to do a book with him, and he asked me to do another book with him. So that worked out well. But Brian, working with Brian, he would make me draw things that I would like never draw in my life. He would be like, okay, now draw some cop cars. And I was like, oh, cop cars. And it's like, now draw like a, you know, a packed city street, or like, you know, this kind of, I was always having to draw things that I didn't want to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't, you know, if left up to my own devices, I would never draw another car in my life.
But was there a value in being forced to get out of your comfort zones that way?
Oh, of course, because, you know, it just makes you a stronger artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having to work with someone else. And I was really lucky to work with Brian because he and I think, have a very similar, like, sensibility.
Uh-huh.
As far as, like, the stories that we want to tell. And when I would get a page from him, like a script, I could see it in my head without even really thumbnailing it very much. You know, it'd just be like, it's very easy for me to read.
But what about like working with somebody like Gerard? Like, you don't even have to say anyone, but is there anyone who you read their pages and you have to work overtime to then create their vision?
The Killjoy stuff has been very, very challenging for me. Mm-hmm. I think because it's such a visual comic.
Yeah, and surrealistic in so many ways too.
It's surrealistic and like hyper realistic. It's crazy. So there's a lot of stuff in there, and I think having the videos and the music and stuff, all this, I don't want to say baggage because it's not, it's like extra, you know, information. Yeah, all this other information that's coming in and getting filtered through. So it's like all these things you have to kind of take into consideration when you're creating this world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so much going on that it's, you know, I'm definitely trying to focus on solid storytelling with these books, just because there's so many characters and so many things. So trying to hit those emotional beats with that many characters has been a challenge, but I think it's exciting.
Yeah, and it's definitely working out. Like, both Andrea and I think are big fans of that series, and I've been very impressed on the execution of it and how difficult it is to bring that world to life in a comic and have it make sense.
Yeah, and I'm drawing some stuff in there, and I was just like, well, how do I even represent this? I mean, I can see the words written, and I kind of have an idea in my head of what it would look like, but to actually draw it and make it make sense.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of action. There's a lot of action, things that, you know, we wait until the sixth issue. It's just like, it's mind blowing.
That's beginning of December, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I actually really appreciate all of the, it's not baggage. It's context for me.
Like context. I say baggage. It's extra stuff to worry about.
But
baggage sounds so negative. It's not really that at all.
Right. And I approach it the same way that I do any other kind of process back matter stuff, where it gives you more information about the entire world. And so I've really enjoyed the process of the translation into like a comic form for telling the story. And yeah. I didn't know the music. I didn't know the video until Aaron shared it with me a couple months ago when we were talking about the beginning part of the series. So at that point, I was kind of blown away by the juxtaposition of the two different types of visuals. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about how that was potentially an obstacle, or at least like a challenge with the working visually with all of that pre-existing information to kind of process and filter through.
Yeah, and we're trying to make it so that you know, if you're not familiar with it, it would, you know, you'd still be able to understand and appreciate the comic, but
yeah, absolutely.
If you are familiar, it kind of adds a totally different dimension to what you're reading.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, that kind of goes into my next question about your process as well, and the kind of, what do you have going on in the background when you're working? Do you listen to music? Do you watch movies? Do you try to make that media consumption match the kind of work you're working on to get yourself into the mood? Like, how do you find that kind of artistic, you know, center? Or do you just compartmentalize and work on drawing when you're working on drawing and keep that stuff separate?
Well, I definitely listen to music a lot, and podcasts. I listen to some podcasts, and it depends on what I'm doing or what time of day it is. You know, if I'm writing or trying to thumbnail or anything, either I won't have anything on and I'll want it quiet, or I will try to listen to something that's more instrumental, mm-hmm. or it's not in English, so I don't get distracted with the words, you know. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, I'll go on All of Murder, She Wrote is on Netflix. And you can just put that on in the background and kind of not pay attention. Like anything like, you know, Law and Order, Murder, She Wrote, or like, you know, Miss Marple or Poirot. Murder mysteries, like, basically.
There's a theme there, absolutely.
There's a theme there. So, but those are easy to put on and, like, kind of not really pay attention to.
Yeah.
So if we see you drawing a Murder, She Wrote ongoing series from IDW, we'll know where the inspiration was from that.
Exactly.
Oh, my God, I would buy that. I would absolutely buy that.
I heard they're going to remake it or do a reboot.
They are. She's not a writer in the remake. She's she's a hospital administrator.
Hospital dramas.
I just read this. She's a hospital administrator and she's like a writer on the side. It's not like she's
So she writes like fan fiction.
That's kind of what it sounded like.
Amazing. Oh, I hope she writes like Sherlock/ fan
fiction. that would be excellent.
It would have to be on Showtime then.
Yeah. And then IDW can pick that one up. And
right.
And then, and it'll be perfect.
Right. And then like I could adapt the Sherlock fan fiction that she's
This is getting very meta. This is like very meta Murder, She Wrote kind of.
But yet still I would buy all of those. So
see?
I'm waiting for the Quincy ongoing. Or Hill Street Blues. Come on. There's a lot of things we could resurrect from the 70s that
or not.
No. Maybe not.
But we're not doing that.
Well, I feel like it's a little bit the elephant in the room to talk about the fact that you're a woman in the comics industry. But I also feel like it would be a cop-out if we didn't address it. And I'll be honest, I'm sort of struggling with this a lot right now and how I feel about it personally. So rather than lead the witness, how do you feel about it? I mean, is it a thing? Is it an issue, a challenge, a cross you have to bear, or not?
I've never felt like it's a challenge or a burden at all. It's one of those things that you don't even think about. And then one day, you know, I was asked to be at a Women in Comics panel, and I was like, this is a thing. And it's been a thing for a long time. And, you know, it's definitely, I think, more at the forefront now, because people are asking the question, like, do we really need to still be talking about this?
Mm-hmm.
And on one hand, I feel the same way. I feel like, why are we still talking about this? Haven't we gotten over this? But on the other hand, every Women in Comics panel I do, they're always amazing. And there's always, you know, some girls that come up to me after the panel and tell me, you know, how inspiring it was and how they, you know, oh, I really want to do comics, but I was never sure. And so as long as there's, you know, still that doubt in young women's minds.
I've been thinking about this too, and I think it's sorry to interject, but I think there's two separate issues when it comes to this, and it almost feels like after talking to a few creators that it's not so much the industry side that still thinks it's something. I think it's almost like the fans side, like as consumers of comics, and I think it's men especially might have more of that, like, or as the comics fans might have more of that, oh, women making comics as a novelty. I think that's changing rapidly, but there's still that sort of generation where it's, oh, okay, I guess there's female artists and female writers who are writing the stories I grew up with, you know, when it comes to DC and Marvel.
I've run into a few, you know, at conventions, you'll run into people who, you know, they don't realize that I'm an artist. You know, I'm sitting at the table and my banner's there and my name's on all the books, but then they're like, oh, you're the artist. Or we thought that you were, you know, somebody's girlfriend.
Or the sidekick, you
know,
right.
Just people, you know, coming up and being generally surprised that they're, wow, there's so many women here. Yeah.
So to go back to those girls that come up to you and they're excited about comics, either, you know, getting involved and being in the industry, or just excited about reading them. What do you say to them? And if they say, like, I want to get into the industry, what do I do? What do you say to them? And isn't any different if a little boy comes up to you and says, I love what you do and I want to be involved in comics?
There's not really too much difference. I mean, the first thing I always tell people is, well, start making comics, you know, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get them into people's hands and go to conventions and put them on the internet. You know, make friends, basically. Be a good person. But I think, you know, when I was teaching actually at SVA for a while, and I taught a portfolio class for the cartooning students, and I always felt like, you know, my class was always half girls at least, which was awesome. But I, you know, I think there's a few things that I've learned, I think, just from doing this is, you know, don't put your phone number on your business cards that you hand out to people, because I've gotten some weird people. And I don't know if guys get that too. If you hand if you've got your business card and you hand it out to people at conventions, mm-hmm. like fans,
mm-hmm.
then they have your, and then you start getting like breathy phone calls in the middle of the night. You're like, what? So yeah, that's happened.
Wow.
And then you just end up changing your number because you don't want to deal with it. But it's, you know, that's like one of those things where you realize, okay, I'm going to have a public email and a public card, and then I'll, you know, have to write my number on phone cards if I give it out to like editors or something.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have
a different perspective, honestly, because you're a guy, that this kind of thing isn't unusual. I mean, I'm hearing you say like, whoa, and what you said a couple minutes ago about it being mostly the fans.
Oh no, let's go back. I was saying whoa that Becky would have her number on her card, because I'm not shocked at all that you would get weird phone calls.
It's, you know, it's like you're just starting, and I think I was probably like 19 or 20 or something.
Yeah.
And you don't realize it. You think like, oh, it's a professional thing. You know, I'm going to this thing, I'm going to hand out my card. And you don't realize that it's like, okay, there's going to be creeps there.
Yeah.
You right. know, just it's like a naivete, I guess. I was naive and young and innocent.
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest that for anyone, but yeah, but for women, it's definitely different.
Yeah. And I think that's one of those things, and it's, you know, I'm pretty lucky. I've never had, you know, really any weird experience, like industry experiences. I've had like the awkward, you know, things happen every once in a while, like, you know, con experiences, but nothing like, you know, I've heard some stories from people, and it's like, you know, shocks sometimes and astounds me in like a really bad way.
It's probably no different than any other social interactions when it comes down to it.
Any other industry, especially like a male-dominated industry, mm-hmm. you know. But I think in the end, it's going to be one of those things where, you know, when you go to conventions, look at like the exhibitors and like half of them are girls.
Yep.
You know, half of them are, you know, like if you go to TCAF or, you know, any other, like especially independent shows.
I'm just kind of curious. This is the first year you went to, I live in Eugene, Oregon. And so you went to the Stumptown Comics convention.
Yeah.
And to me, that's my favorite show as a fan because it's so indie focused. I was just kind of curious of this is totally a self-serving question because it's as a Oregon guy, the comics industry in Portland especially is so strong. I was just kind of curious your impression of kind of the people you met there, that convention, and Portland in general.
Portland, I really like Portland. I've been there a few times. Just to visit. I've never been to Stumptown before, mm-hmm. but this was like my first Portland con. I really like that city. It's, well, I think the convention, first of all, was excellent. And it was like just the right size, you know, it's like it wasn't too big and it wasn't too small. And they had a pottery convention, I think, going on at the same time.
Yeah, I think so. Right.
Which is awesome. That was a lot of fun. It was like well organized, well run. Everyone who went was really cool. Mm-hmm. But Portland is always fun. You know, I don't know if I necessarily like it's weird because you go to shows and I'll see like the same people there as I see at other shows
right.
just because, you know, like Ming Doyle was there. That was awesome. And like Dash Shaw was there and he's really cool. But it's like I'll see these people, you know, all the time. So it's like, wow, I don't necessarily know if the, you know, the convention was great and the fans were really cool. But I don't know.
Yeah. No, I don't know if there was any too much depth to that question. It was,
was entirely self-serving.
It was totally self-serving. I just
hijacked the conversation about, you know, women in the industry to talk about Portland.
I get one like Chris Farley show type question every interview from now on. I just wanted it to be like.
I don't know if I could ever live in Portland.
Why is that?
I don't know. It's really far away from the East Coast. It's a bit wacky.
Well, yes, sometimes. It is a little far away.
Sometimes it's a bit wacky when I go and visit. I'm like, oh, I really like it here, but I don't know if I could live here. Uh-huh.
Yeah, if you're an East Coast person, Portland is probably the opposite of that.
I just relocated from the East Coast to the San Francisco Bay Area about a year ago. That is a big adjustment.
How do you like it?
I love it out here, but there's no denying the fact that it's really fucking far away.
Yeah.
And you can't just bop over for anything. Like it's a whole process to get from one side of the country to the other. So
it is a process.
Yeah. Well, I actually do have a segue from that last question. Since we're talking about work, conventions, et cetera, so what do you do to escape?
To escape
from work. From work, from comics. What do you do to decompress?
Well, let me see.
Or do you? Because sometimes we found that people don't.
Well, I don't know if I do too much.
Mm-hmm.
I guess conventions are my that doesn't really count, does it?
No.
let's see. Well, right now I haven't been able to do much decompressing in general. I don't know. I can't really say that I have an answer to that.
Do you work 7 days a week, 6 days a week?
Seven. Occasionally I'll just, you know, burn out and have to take a day off because I just can't be bothered.
Right.
But, you know, most of the time you're always on. And it's actually with the self-publishing stuff, that kept me really busy. I used to joke that I would, like, take a break from doing comics by doing more comics.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is the break for you? The self-published stuff or the, you know, other comics that you're working on?
I think it would be the self-publishing stuff. I mean, that's, like, you know, those little stories are, like, really, I mean, they're a lot of fun to do. And it's nice to work with, you know, I haven't written in so long that when I did Wolves a few years ago, it was like the first time I'd written in a very long time. And it was just kind of, you know, I wasn't sure if I was able to, and I just more of an experiment, and it went really well. So then I decided to do a few more. So that's been good.
Hmm.
And now I'm all about short stories.
Yeah. You just put a link up for one just the other day, right?
Oh, that was actually a short story that I wrote, like actual written. That's my first ever prose. Actual words.
Yeah, we'll put a link up to that up on our site if anybody missed it when you posted it.
Yeah, it was like a Halloween story, but it's still up. It's still scary.
Yeah.
It hasn't become unscary since Halloween.
Scary stuff is timeless, right?
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not scary. It's a little bit silly, but it's kind of fun.
So I guess that's a great segue to, I love these. Speaking of scary, what are you afraid of? What's your greatest fear?
Greatest fear. Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess it would just be like normal for just say death. Like, isn't that enough? I'm more scared of, I think, other people dying than I am of myself dying. Because, you know, once you die, that's it. Mm-hmm. You probably won't really be thinking about anything else.
Is that a fear that you've had since you were a child?
I don't know. That's just something that you think about. It's like, you know, it's one of those things that you're aware of from what you're a very young age. But it happens to everyone, so there's no escaping it, really. So what's the point, I guess, of being afraid of it? Yeah. I think more than anything, I'd be afraid of just, like, you know, I've basically put all my eggs into this basket of comics. And what if one day I don't have, I, like, lose that ability to tell a story, or, like lose my inspiration somehow, or, you know, start making stories that no one really wants to read anymore. Mm-hmm. That's really it, I guess.
How do you handle when you get frustrated with your own work?
Throw things.
Well, I guess
no one's supposed to know that. this doesn't happen too often, but like I'll rip pages up and like, you know, throw shit on the floor and stomp around. It's usually when no one's around, or try to make it so that it's like, you know.
When you look at finished pages of your work, do you only see the flaws, or can you actually step back and say, like, damn it, I totally nailed that. That's awesome.
I think with every page, the point is just to make each page better than the one that you did before. So it's important to see the flaws, you know, even if it's, you know, you don't want to let that hold you back by undermining any confidence that you have in your work.
Sure.
And on one hand, it's like, you know, to have a flaw in a page, I can look at something and, you know, of course, in every comic, on every page, I'm going to be like, I should redraw that panel, or I would redraw that face, or, you know, there's always going to be something that I'm not happy with. But less than just the draftsmanship, I think the overall storytelling is important, the most important part. So if I can look through the story and, you know, yeah, even if there's a few drawings that I would have handled differently, or I would go back and redo if I had the chance, if I'm happy with the overall story, it kind of negates any of those qualities, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you start looking too closely at the individual pages as pages and not as part of a larger story, then of course you're gonna lose sight of what you accomplished, like big picture, like literally big picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's what comics are all about. It's the big picture of it. Now, it doesn't stop me from like fantasizing about redrawing a bunch of panels in my comic. But you know.
Well, on a lighter note, so besides Wolves, The Mire, and Demeter, what comics should people be reading?
Anything by Emily Carroll. She just put up a comic for Halloween, and it's the creepiest thing. She's got a few shorts out in like a few anthologies, and I think she's doing a collection of all her web strips, but you can just find her work online, and like anything she does is amazing. It sends shivers up my spine.
Anything else that you read regularly, or that you wish that you had time to read?
I have like a box at my store, and so, you know, I have like a monthly issue, so I read Hellboy constantly, which is always in my pull and BPRD. It's been like consistently one of my favorite comics for a very long time. I also, Young Avengers has been a lot of fun. X titles, I always pick up like X-Men, you know, Batman, Snyder and Capullo, I think it's like my favorite out of the new 52 stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's see what else. I just picked up the Richard Corbin Halloween special he did with the Poet Adaptations.
Oh, yeah, those have been great.
That was amazing. Yeah, that was really good. Yeah. You know, I get a lot of books from like conventions too, I think. So I was just at New York Comic Con, and I got Nathan Fox, Dogs of War. I think that's Scholastic. That's incredible. He's great.
I've heard that's really good, and that if you don't like to see animals getting hurt, there's not a lot of that in there. Like, it's very readable for everyone.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's,
and he draws really good dogs. It's not easy. Animals are difficult.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have one last tough question, and it's going to sound like a job interview question because it kind of usually is. But where do you want to be in the industry in 5 years? And what's your dream as a comics creator?
My five-year plan? Mm-hmm.
Kind of, yeah.
Okay. My dream, I want to do more of my own stories. So I've got tons of comics that I want to do. And I have two graphic novels that are completely written, but I haven't been able to work on them. I've got a full kind of an opus. Right now it's 12 graphic novels, but that could maybe change. And there's an outline for that done.
Wow.
So I want to start working on that stuff.
Yeah.
But I want to still keep on doing short stories. And then I'd still like to work with writers as well. So I think what I'm going to try and do is work with writers on shorter, either one shots or smaller things, and kind of flip what I've been doing, where, continue to work with people, because I love the collaborative aspect of comics. You know, I love working with writers. I love working with other artists. So I'm actually talking to an artist right now about doing some writing for him. So that's exciting.
Meaning you would write, but you wouldn't draw your own stuff?
No, I would definitely draw my own stuff too. But I want to make my larger projects the things that I write and draw. And then I want to start writing for other people just for fun.
That's right, awesome. Now.
Maybe it would become something more serious, but just to continue doing little mini comics and things like that. I'd still try to work with writers occasionally. That's my goal. I've got so many stories that I want to tell, so I feel like it's time. The time is ripe.
That's very exciting to hear. No, it's great.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that the graphic novel I'm doing for a second kind of it's an adaptation, but I get to adapt it, and it's a loose adaptation. So
very cool. They've been putting out such amazing stuff, especially in the last 4 or 5 years. I'm really impressed with what First Second picks for their projects and the people they pick for it. So that's very exciting to hear that you're working on that for them.
Yeah, they're great. So I'm really lucky.
Thank you, Becky. This was so incredible. Do you have any last words of wisdom, any other anecdotes or demonstrations of awesomeness to share?
I don't know. No, I think we covered most of it.
Good stuff.
The only thing I can really say, we talked about my short story. Prose is really hard. I don't think I'll ever do prose again.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that's interesting to hear you kind of put that out there and then back off immediately.
Well, I wrote it last year. I wrote it for that Tome anthology,
right?
That the 44 Flood Guys did out in Chicago. Uh-huh. And then it's been kind of on the back burner, and it needed some edits. So I've been editing it slowly over the past year. And a friend of mine just encouraged me to spruce it up and put it out because I was just going to forget about it forever. So then I decided to pull it back out and.
Well, it's good. It goes back to that challenging yourself to get out of the areas if you're comfortable, you feel comfortable in.
Yes, that was a challenge. So that's my words of wisdom. Always challenge yourself, even if you don't feel like it was a 100% successful. Do step out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Your comfort zone was not actually that comfortable to begin with.
Well, we'll let you go. Thank you so much again for being here, taking the time out to be with us. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Remember to pre-order your comics. It means life or death to many titles, especially small press and creator-owned works. And if you love a creator or a comic, let your LCS know and order it for, have them order it for you. Or you might not be able to get to read it again. So that's the last of that browbeating I'll give you for this week. for all things for the show, everything you want to know about us, it's all on comicstherapy.com. And we don't make you pre-order anything, though. So we'll see you next week if you want. Bye.
Thanks, Becky.
Thanks, Becky.
Thank you.